There was an unholy gleam in his eyes as he advanced upon the monstrous vehicle. "Oki has converted a 3-ton Ford truck," he explained to Jeanine. "Lifted the chassis as though it were on stilts." The vehicle's body stood high above the huge lug tyres. "Put in deflectors here," he pointed out the heavy steel V-shaped plates under the cab that would split the blast of a landmine. "Armoured the cab." The body looked like a Tiger tank with steel hatches, a driver's slit and gun ports for a heavy Browning machine gun. "But look what we've got on top." At a glance, it could have been mistaken for the conning tower of a nuclear submarine, and Oki was still wringing his hands. "He's got 20 galvanized steel pipes filled with plastic explosive and 30 pounds of ball bearings in each."
"Good Lord, Bawu."
Even Craig was horrified.
"The damn things will explode."
"He's set them in blocks of concrete," Oki moaned, "and aimed them out on each side just like the cannons on one of Nelson's ships of the line. 10 on each side."
"A 20-gun Ford," Craig breathed with awe.
"When I run into an ambush, I just press the button, and boom, a broadside of 300 pounds of ball bearings into the bastards," Jonathan gloated openly. "A whiff of grape, as old Bonaparte said."
"He's going to blow himself to hell," Oki moaned.
"Oh, do stop being an old woman," Jonathan told him, "and give me a leg up."
"Bawu, this time I really do agree with Oki," Craig tried to stop him. But the old man went up the steel ladder with the agility of a vervet monkey and posed dramatically in the hatchway like the commander of a panzer division.
"I'll set off one broadside at a time, the starboard side first."
Then his eyes lit on Jeanine.
"Would you like to be my co-pilot, my dear?"
"That is astonishingly civil of you, Bawu, but I think I'll get a better view from the irrigation ditch over there."
"Then stand back, everyone." Jonathan made a wide, imperious gesture of dismissal, and the Matabele labourers and drivers, who had been witnesses to Jonathan's previous test, took off like a brigade of Egyptian infantry departing from the Six-Day War. Some of them were still running as they crossed the ridge of the kopje.
Oki reached the irrigation ditch half a dozen paces ahead of Craig and Jeanine, and then the three of them cautiously lifted their heads above the bank. 300 yards away, the grotesque Ford stood in monumental isolation in the middle of the ploughed land, and from the hatchway Jonathan gave them a cheery wave and then disappeared. They covered their ears with both hands and waited. Nothing happened.
"He's chickened out," Craig said hopefully, and the hatch opened again. Jonathan's helmeted head reappeared, his face red with outrage.
"Oki, you son of a bitch, you disconnected the wiring," he roared. "You're fired, do you hear me? Fired!"
"It's the third time he's fired me this week," Oki muttered morosely. "It was the only way I could think of stopping him."
"Hold on, my dear," Jonathan addressed himself to Jeanine. "I'll have it connected up in a jiffy."
"Don't worry on my account, Bawu," she yelled back. But he had disappeared again. The minutes passed, each one a separate eternity, and their hopes gradually rose again.
"It's not going to work. Let's get him out of here."
"Bawu, we're coming to get you," Craig cupped his hands and bellowed. "And you'd better come quietly."
He rose slowly out of the ditch, and at that moment the armoured Ford disappeared in a huge boiling cloud of smoke and dust. A sheet of white flame licked over the field of standing maize, scything it flat as though some monstrous combine harvester had swept across it, and they were enveloped by such an appalling blast of sound that Craig lost his balance and fell back into the ditch on top of the other two. Frantically they scrambled to untangle themselves in the bottom of the ditch, and then looked out fearfully again across the ploughed field. The dreadful silence was broken only by the singing in their own ears, and the dwindling yelps of the old man's pack of savage Rottweilers and Doberman Pinschers as they fled in utter panic back up the road towards the homestead. The field was obscured by a dense curtain of drifting blue smoke and red-brown dust. They climbed up out of the ditch and stared into the smoke and dust, and the breeze blew it gently aside. The Ford lay upon its back. All four of its massive lug tyres were pointing to the heavens, as though in abject surrender.
"Bawu!" Craig cried and raced towards it.
The gaping mouths of the pipe cannons were still oozing oily wreaths of smoke, but there was no other movement. Craig wrestled the steel hatch open and crawled into it on his hands and knees. The dark interior stank of acrid plastic explosive burn.
Bawu!
He found him crumpled in the bottom of the cab, and he knew instantly that the old man was in extremis. The whole shape of his face had altered, and his voice was an unintelligible blur. Craig caught him up in his arms and tried to drag him towards the hatch, but the old man fought him off with desperate strength, and at last Craig understood what he was saying.
My teeth! You've blown my bloody teeth out!
He was back on his hands and knees, searching desperately.
Mustn't let her see me! Find them, boy, find them!
Craig found the missing plates under the driver's seat, and with them once more in place, Jonathan shot out of the hatchway and confronted Ockie van Rensburg furiously.
You made it top-heavy, you blithering old idiot.
You can't talk to me like that, Bawu. I don't work for you any longer. You just fired me.
You're hired, bellowed Jonathan. Now get that thing right away up again.
20 sweating, singing Matabele heaved the Ford slowly upright, and at last it flopped over onto its wheels again.
Looks like a banana, Ockie remarked with obvious satisfaction. The recoil of your cannons has bent it almost double. You'll never get that chassis straight again.
There's only one way to straighten it, Jonathan announced, and began tightening the strap of his tin helmet again.
What are you going to do, John? Craig demanded anxiously. Fire the other broadside, of course, said Jonathan grimly. That'll knock it straight again.
But Craig seized one of his arms, Ockie the other, and Jeanine murmured soothingly to him as they led him away to the waiting Land Rover.
Can you imagine Bawu reaching for the cigarette lighter and hitting the wrong button while driving down Main Street, Craig chortled, and letting that lot go through the front doors of the City Hall?
They giggled over it the whole way back to town. And as they drove in past the lovely lawns of the Municipal Gardens, Craig suggested easily,
Sunday evening in Bulawayo, you could suffer a nervous breakdown from the mad gaiety of it. Let me cook you one of my famous dinners on the yacht and save you from it.
The yacht? Jeanine was instantly intrigued. Here? 1,500 miles from the nearest salt water?
I will say no more, Craig declared. Either you come with me, or you will forever be consumed by unsatisfied curiosity.
A fate worse than death, she agreed. And I always have been a good sailor. Let's go. Craig took the airport road. But before they left the built-up area, he turned into one of the older sections of the town. Between two run-down cottages was an empty plot. It was screened from the road by the dense greenery of a row of ancient mango trees. Craig parked the Land Rover under one of the mango trees and led her deeper into an unkempt jungle of bougainvillea and acacia trees, until she stopped abruptly and exclaimed,
"You weren't kidding. It's a real yacht."
"They don't come any realer than that," Craig agreed proudly. "Lavranos designed, 45 feet overall length, and every plank laid by my own lily whites."
"Craig, she's beautiful."
"She will be one day when I finish her."
The vessel stood on a wooden cradle, with baulks of timber chocking the sides. The deep keel and ocean-going hull lifted the stainless steel deck railings 15 feet above Jeanine's head as she ran forward eagerly.
"How do I get up?"
"There's a ladder round the other side."
She scrambled up onto the deck and called down.
"What's her name?"
"She hasn't got one yet."
He climbed up into the cockpit beside her.
"When will you launch her, Craig?"
"The good Lord knows," he smiled. "There's a mountain of work to be done on her yet, and every time I run out of money, everything comes to a grinding halt."
He was unlocking the hatch as he spoke, and the moment he swung it open, Jeanine ducked down the companionway.
"It's cozy down here."
"Well, this is where I live."
He climbed down into the saloon after her and dropped his kit bag on the deck.
"I've finished her off below decks. The galley's through there. 2 cabins each with double bunks, a shower and a chemical toilet."
"It's beautiful,"
Jeanine repeated, running her fingers over the varnished teak joinery and then bouncing experimentally on the couches.
"Beats paying rent," he agreed. What remains to be done?
Oh, not much. Engine, winches, rigging, sails. Only about $20,000 worth. However, I've just soaked Barwoo for almost half of that.
He lit the gas refrigerator and then selected a tape and put it on the player.
Janine listened to the liquid purling piano for a few moments and then said, Ludwig van B, of course.
Of course. Who else?
Then, with slightly less assurance, she said,
The Pathétique Sonata?
Oh, very good, he grinned as he found a bottle of Sonneblum Riesling in one of the cupboards.
And the artiste?
Oh, come on.
Give it a shot.
Is it Kentner?
No, not bad, but it's Pressler. She pulled a face to show her mortification, and he drew the cork and half-filled the glasses with pale golden wine.
Here's looking at you, kid.
She sipped and murmured.
That's good.
Dinner.
Craig dived back into the cupboard.
Rice and canned stuff. The potatoes and onions are 3 months old, growing sprouts already.
Macrobiotic, she said.
Good for you.
Can I help?
They worked happily shoulder to shoulder in the tiny galley, and every time they moved, they brushed against each other. She smelt of scented soap, and when he looked down on top of her head, her curly hair was so dense and lustrous that he had an almost uncontrollable urge to bury his face in it. Instead, he went to look for another bottle of wine. He emptied 4 assorted cans into the pot, chopped onions and potatoes over the mixture, and spooned in curry powder. He served it on a bed of rice.
Delicious, Janine declared. What do you call it?
Don't ask embarrassing questions.
When you launch her, where will you sail her?
Craig reached over her head and brought down a chart and an Indian Ocean pilot from the bookshelves.
All right, he pointed out a position on the chart. Here we are, anchored in a secluded little cove on an island in the Seychelles. If you look out the porthole, you'll see the palm trees and the beaches whiter than sugar. Under us, the water is so clear that we seem to be floating in air.
Janine looked out of the porthole.
You know what? You're right. There are the palm trees, and I can hear guitars.
When they finished eating, they pushed the dishes aside and pored over the books and charts.
Where next? How about the Greek islands?
No, too touristy. Australia and the Barrier Reef?
Beauty. She mimicked an Aussie accent.
Can I go topless sport?
Bottomless too, if you want.
Rude boy.
The wine had flushed her cheeks and put a sparkle in her eyes. She slapped his cheek lightly, and he knew he could kiss her then. But before he moved, she said,
Roland told me you were a dreamer.
The name stopped him dead. He felt the coldness in his chest, and suddenly he was angry with her for spoiling the mood of the moment. He wanted to hurt her as she had just hurt him.
Are you sleeping with him? He asked,
and she swayed back and stared at him with shock. Then her eyes slanted like those of a cat, and the rims of her nostrils turned bone white with fury.
What did you say?
His own perversity would not let him turn back from the precipice, and he stepped out over it.
I asked if you were sleeping with him.
Are you sure you want to know?
Yes.
All right, the answer is yes, and it's bloody marvellous, okay?
Okay, he said miserably.
Now you can take me home, please.
They drove in complete silence except for her terse directions, and when he parked outside the 3-story block of apartments, he noticed that they were called Beau Vallon, the same as the Seychelles beach over which they had fantasized. She climbed out of the Land Rover.
I'm grateful for the lift,
she said, and walked up the paved path towards the entrance of the building. Before she reached it, she turned and came back.
Do you know that you are a spoilt little boy? She asked. And that you give up on everything, just like you did on the tennis court.
This time she disappeared into the entrance of the building without looking back. When he got back to the yacht, Craig put the charts and books away. Then he cleaned the dishes, dried them, and stacked them in their racks. He thought he had left a bottle of gin in one of the cupboards, but he couldn't find it.
There wasn't even any of the wine left. He sat in the saloon with the gas light hissing softly over his head, and he felt numb and empty. There was no point in going to his bunk. He knew he would not sleep. He unlaced the kit bag. The leather-bound journal that Jonathan had loaned him was on top. He opened it and began to read. It had been written in 1860. The writer was Zuga Ballantyne, Craig's great-great-grandfather. After a while, Craig no longer felt numb and empty, for he was on the quarter-deck of a tall ship, running southwards down the green Atlantic towards a savage, enchanted continent.